Hi, everybody. I'm Bill Whittle here with my friend and colleague, Alfonso Rachel, and this is The Virtue Signal, where we try to look at some of the philosophy and morality underneath the politics of the day. So today we have, we're going to start off with the, you know, the mastermind of liberal thinking, Trevor Noah, the great philosopher. He made a comment, and I'm not so much interested in the specifics about this, but I am interested in a bigger issue. Now that Joe Biden is in charge of our foreign policy again, or at least whoever is in charge of Joe Biden, is in charge of our foreign policy. Situation is acting up again with Israel being attacked and so on and so forth. And Trevor Noah sent out a tweet, and here's a direct quote. I just want to ask an honest question here. If you are in a fight where the other person cannot beat you, how much should you retaliate when they try to hurt you? Now, it's difficult to plumb the depths of the progressive mind under any circumstances, but with Trevor Noah, it's a unique challenge. But I think what he's saying here is, since the Palestinians really can't really hurt Israel, then there shouldn't be any retaliation at all. That's what it sounds like. Why would you hit back at somebody who can't hurt you? Well, first of all, if a rocket lands on your head, it hurts you quite a lot. But that's not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is this. I want to talk about the cult of the underdog. Because certainly what we've seen with the Israelis and the Palestinians, and we see it everywhere, it's one of the big levers of progressive movement. And that's the idea that whoever is powerless is automatically morally correct.
Yes, that the virtue of the poor and the virtue of the weak and stuff like that. You know, it's not always a good idea to underestimate your enemy or overestimate your enemy or anything like that, or this idea that just because somebody is weaker that you can't defend yourself against them. Sometimes people even use their weakness as an advantage point to be a bully. Right.
Absolutely right. That's what the whole cry bully movement is all about.
Yes. Like, and it's like one of those things where no matter what, you can't win. You know, it's like, and I know this is going to sound very, politically incorrect and chauvinist and stuff like that. It's kind of like being in a fight with a girl, right? No. You can't win.
It is. Well, right? That's right. If you lose, you lost to a girl. Mm-hmm. And if you win, congratulations, you beat up a girl.
Right.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly what it's like.
Yeah. And that's where we are. And this is one of those things where I'm not going to let these heathens shame us, man. When it gets right down to it, it's like, you hypocritical heathens, I'm not going to let you guys pass judgment on me. I'm going to go ahead and stick to how the Lord himself even did it. So it's like they want to look at, you know, the Lord and his flock as a bunch of meek sheep and all that sort of stuff. And the Lord rose up just before he's arrested. He wants it to be very clear. Look, man. I got some Hebrews that are ready to get into a serious knife fight and they can get down. All right. Peter jerked out his sword and with one stroke cut off this dude's ear. And by the way, I got 12 legions of angels, man, with who's got the really hot knives. And I myself, man, I can take on all of you with no problem. Hey, are you Jesus? Yes, I am. And every one of them buckled to their knees. Now I'm going to let you arrest me because I'm going to let you. All right. So we understand the story. But even Jesus himself, it's like, look, man, I'm not going to let you guys, just because you're weaker, I don't underestimate you. Right. And I'm going to let the whole world know the power that you guys have. But then again, I'm going to let you guys know the power that I have too. And you don't want to mess with me. Right. So when we talk about peace through strength, right, the Lord had already laid out the standard as far as that goes. So all that to say, Bill, is that, you know, these guys who are going to try to pass judgment on a place that's defending itself, it's like, no. The real cowardice, the real shame is in somebody who's thinking that just because they're seen as weak, you know, that they're seen as weak, that they have the right to go around picking on people. And I want to, if I can say this really quick, Bill, these are the lessons that are learned right in the origins of Al-Quran. See, the thing in Al-Quran is the lesson of victimhood. In Al-Quran, in the perverted creation of man, Iblis you can relate to Iblis, right? In the Bible, the devil is introduced to us as our enemy right off the bat. In the Quran, he's introduced as someone that you can relate to. He's a victim right off the bat. He's a victim in that, hey, why should I prostrate before Adam? He's made of clay and I'm made of fire. I'm superior to him. Now, right there, you can say like, yeah, why should the devil have to prostrate before Adam? He's obviously a superior human, not a human being, but he's obviously a superior being. Right. So right there, you can already see the victim mentality already setting in. And we can see that that these are the strategies that people use to influence other people to advance their evil. The Palestinians do it. The Islamic cult does it. The Democrats do it. The Nazi regime did it. They hated the Jews. They used the victim mentality and the jealousy of what they had, and why should they have to prostrate before these people and want it to be the superior Aryan race, which is following the Persian race, oddly enough, right? But following the whole principle of exterminating the Jews. This goes all the way back even to the Exodus. The reason why the Pharaoh was so he wasn't afraid of the power of the Jews for them rising up against him. He was afraid that they would leave, right? But all the, and why? Dude, are you such a victim that you can't even handle them leaving? So the whole victim mentality and the reasons that people use to get away with bullying other people, and these people can't strike back, man. It's just as old as mankind itself.
Yeah, that's really a lot to unpack there. The traditional and the original underdog story has got to be David and Goliath, right? Mm. And it's pretty clear whose side you're supposed to be on in that story. Mm. I mean, that story leaves no moral question about whether Goliath was in the right. The entire reason that story of David and Goliath, the David and Goliath is just a term that people drop pretty much every day. Mm. It hits such an important part of our psychology, this idea that you can overcome overwhelming odds. It's kind of built into the human psyche. And so when you start out with a story like this, where you've got this one young guy with a sling and you've got this giant warrior, and hey, look, the guy who's pure of heart with virtually no weapons is able to bring down a much more powerful foe. Mm. Okay, got it. Good lesson. But what we're seeing today, and again, I don't want to limit this to Israel. In fact, I really prefer to talk about it domestically more than anything, is that after a while, you see so many underdog stories in the movies. You see so many. I mean, that, there's no story to be told. If it turned out that a college team of misfits were to take on the Yankees, and then the Yankees beat them 62-0, it's not really a story there. You know what I mean? You always create these stories about the underdog facing incredible odds, and either they succeed in most cases, or in the case of like the first Rocky movie, they don't win the fight, but they go the distance, so they succeed morally. We've told so many stories about the underdog triumphing because of his moral authority and his persistence and all the rest, that we become conditioned to believe that the underdog is always right. But that's just not the case. It's just not. Just because a boy is throwing a rock at a tank doesn't make the boy right. In point of fact, if a kid throws a rock at a tank and the tank doesn't fire back, that tells you about something about the people in the tank.
Yes.
And this worship of the underdog, this automatic assumption that the weaker you are, the more oppressed you've been, the more tormented you've been, continues to raise not only your level of truth but your moral authority is built into the entire progressive movement, and that is how they're doing what they're doing. The entire plan of the Frankfurt School was to say, okay, look, the workers are not going to be the vanguard of the communist revolution because these damn capitalists are producing so much wealth that in America, these workers have cars and toilets and stuff. So they had to make it about the dispossessed. You've got to find people who have a grievance. Mm-hmm. And when you promote a philosophy that the grievance is the basis for truth, moral authority, action, all of it, you come down to this phenomenon, which I see everywhere, which is the cult of the underdog.
Yeah, and you're right, Bill. We see these things in movies. It's kind of like this entertainment conditioning that we have. But you know, there are moments in the movies, and there are these rare moments, but they really stick out. But it reminds me really from when I was a kid, man. I remember there was this dog, man. We had this dog in this neighborhood, and nobody could stand this dog. And then one day somebody came into the neighborhood with a horse, you know, this big, beautiful horse. And this dog came just like yapping at this horse, like, rawr, 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 rawr. And this horse, man, it just back kicked this dog and just launched it across the street, right? That was a moment of joy for us. Now, we weren't thinking, oh, that horse, that big bully horse, it's just so mean. It just kicked that. No, that dog was getting on people's nerves. So we were like kind of happy that that dog got handled, you know, or there was a movie. I can't remember which movie it was, you know, and I guess, you know, the uppity, stuffy, stuck up boyfriend is kind of like picking on, you know, the girl's new boyfriend and whichever. And this guy's obviously a bully. He's not stronger. You know, he's obviously a weaker guy, but he's, you know, the intellectual superior and very successful and all that sort of stuff. And while the girl's not looking, she kind of looks away and dude just reaches across the table, just knocks him out, right? And the guy's just like in a full-on stupor. So it's like one of those moments where it was nice to see, you know, the stronger guy, because you know that he's getting picked on by the weaker guy. And the stronger guy just stepped up and just like handled it and just kind of gave the guy a humbling experience. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe we don't see enough of that, because, and maybe, hey, that's a new fashion. Maybe that's a new trend that we can introduce in entertainment media, where it's like the weaker guy just decides that he's going to, because man, we're seeing that, Bill. We're seeing this culture of weaker, jelly-spined people who are using what they have to try to strong arm the strong. We're seeing a lot of that. And they're doing it, you know, of course, out of fear, and they're doing it out of sense of inadequacy and all that other, you know, stuff that we can, you know, that we can try to introduce in terms of what their behavior is reflective of. But we're seeing a lot of that.
You know, you talked about that horse kick moment as being almost like a flash of joy. It reminds me of a movie that came out early 2000s, right at the beginning of the Gulf War, maybe even preceded it, of the Iraq War, maybe even preceded a little bit. It's called The Kingdom. And I want to say it was directed by a Frenchman, but basically it was about a terrorist attack in Saudi Arabia. And then Americans are trying to track down the people that did it, but you spend a lot of time with the terrorists and you're supposed to think, oh, these guys have got a real cause. And who can say who's right and who's wrong? But the anecdote is that they screened this for an American audience. And then when the American soldiers come into this room and just start gunning down all the terrorists, the audience just breaks into applause. And the director practically comes out of his chair and say, no, you're not supposed to be rooting for them. Mm. You know, they're the powerful ones. You're supposed to be rooting for the terrorists. But people can grade the moral difference. You talked also about this jellyfish kind of like response, a spineless jellyfish kind of thing. Mm. What it is, and you hit it off on exactly on the first beat, was it is a defense mechanism to basically say, I'm going to attack you as often as I want to, but you are not allowed to hit me back. Mm. You sometimes see feminists doing this, you know, sure, just punching guys in the face all the time and just absolutely secure in the knowledge that there's not going to be any retaliation. Mm. And so you use weakness as a shield from which you can, well, maybe it's better to think of it as like an ambush, you know? You're hiding behind your weakness. You can shoot all the arrows you want to. And then when it's time for retaliation, you get to hide behind this weakness thing. And this is the point, for me anyway, is that once again, it's the left using people's common decency against them. People don't want to hit people that are weaker than they are. Mm. I was raised to see, you know, never hit a girl, you never hit a guy with glasses. And they know this about us. And so they use our decency against us. If you call somebody a racist who's not a racist for disagreeing with you, and that person shuts up, the reason they shut up is because they're not a racist. They don't want to be thought of as a racist. So political correctness is based on this sense of, I'm going to use that person's decency against them. I'm going to call them racist. What they said has nothing to do with race, but I'm going to call them that anyway to get them to shut up, because they're good people. Mm. And good people don't want to be seen to be hitting back at people who are weaker than they are, but it's a strategy. You called it that earlier. It's a strategy. It's a tactic designed to allow somebody to attack you with impunity.
Yes. Yeah, and it's somehow people have to be able to see the difference. You know, it's not like, you know, a bigger person coming up and just, I'm going to bully a smaller person. I'm going to do this. I'm going to say things to them, or I'm going to hit them, or whichever. It's one of those things where you got to see where they had it coming. You know, this person is making all the taunts and they're thinking that they can get away with all this sort of stuff. And there's a way to handle certain people where you don't have to have this overkill of strength to be able to dispatch of a person, you know, even if they're weaker and stuff like that. But see, once again, though, Bill, that's where it comes down to the problem of perception, because if a person is going to want to see the person as the weaker who didn't do anything. Right. They're able to just get away with what they're doing with. Like, you know, when we talk about, the body cams and stuff like that, people are going to see what they want to see. You can have the evidence on the body cam that the suspect was doing everything wrong. Right. It's like, dude, you really shouldn't have done that. And you got the body cam footage. No, they didn't show the whole footage. And, you know, and they're going to want some other angles. And they're going to look for any excuse to say that, hey, the police officer was the bully. Right. So this kind of thing. It goes deeper than, of course, the politics. It goes deeper than the culture. It's a spiritual thing. You know, it's a thing where you can have somebody look right at something and it's like, you don't see that? Really? Did it somehow magically disappear? Or what are we? We're not looking at the same thing here. And from there, you know, that's a spiritual thing. It's not just a thing of evidence. You can produce the evidence and say, look, man, it's right here. If they don't want to perceive it that way, they're just not going to.
Exactly. And so that reliance on weakness as an ambush position to shoot from is the strategy. But the deployment, in order to deploy that strategy, you have to have the assistance of the media. And the reason the media is able to make that strategy work is because the media controls the frame. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're watching me in a frame. You don't know whether I'm wearing pants. You don't know whether there's a clown sitting on the couch. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say clown. I meant to say a mime.
Yeah.
You don't know what's happening outside the frame. You can't see what's outside the frame. And furthermore, you can't see what's outside the frame in terms of what happens before the recording and what happens after the recording. The frame limits your perception in space and time, and the ability to control that all the information you're going to get is inside of this space and at this particular length of time is unbelievably powerful. Mm-hmm. You could cut together a montage of people just up and punching people in the face endlessly, and you could just say, my God, you look at this, these people are horrible, they all need to be in jail. But if it turned out that what you had edited was just the response, if all you saw was just people punching people, you'd go, what horrible people. Mm-hmm. But if you showed the whole clip, you would see that, no, somebody else has been pushing this guy, punching this guy, punching this guy, and this is just the moment when he hits back. And it's not only justified, you realize the guy's actually a hero. So when we saw this, again, early 2000s, I forget the name of this kid, but there was an Israeli situation where they're shooting Israelis and this kid got shot. It turns out that they put this boy there to get shot so that they could use the power of the frame to make the case to disarm. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yes.
The cult of the underdog disarms people who are in the right. People who are evil or trying to manipulate you or just plain wrong will use the cult of the underdog to protect themselves against people who are correct and right and moral. But in order to do that, they've got to set the frame up so that the underdog image and the underdog dynamic is there, and no possible way to otherwise judge who's right and who's wrong here, other than who looks stronger and who looks weaker.
Empowered victims, right? It's you know, kind of oxymoronic, but you know, to your point, man, about this frame. It's like I said, man. This lesson goes all the way back, you know, to the garden. What excuse did Adam and Eve have? You know, but they were made to think that they were victims, and they wanted to be empowered. So
right.
Despite everything that they saw, I mean, Bill, the universe was their backyard. Right. They had it really good. But here comes the devil with his satanic studio, and he's going to frame it just like this. I want you to look at this just like this. And they did, despite everything else that they saw. But their desire. See, that's what we're dealing with, Bill. We're dealing with desires, man. It's not about evidence. It's not about facts. I wish it were. You know, I wish we could say, hey, man, these are the facts. You know, but when we're dealing with people's desires, that's a whole nother thing. That's a whole nother dynamic to get around. But it's not like it's impossible, but, you know, we're assuming that, you know, which it should be. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to dismiss facts and reason and stuff like that. But that's a lot, that's a language that a lot of people just don't, they don't communicate that way. It's not so much that they can't understand it. It's just, that's not the way to communicate. And there has to be another level of communication, another angle of communication to do that.
No, that's exactly right. And it's one of the many defects of the human character for to be true when you say that for many people, if you really want to get somebody to hate you, do something good for them. No good deed goes unpunished with some people. If you if somebody's in need and you lend them money, they'll never forgive you for it. That's life. And facing life is the essence of what conservatism is and morality and actual virtue. And that's why we do the show, which is made possible by the members at BillWhittle.com who pay $9.95 a month and more sometimes in order to make these shows available to everybody. So on behalf of my friend Alfonso Rezo, I'm Bill Whittle. This is The Virtue Signal. We'll see you next time right here at BillWhittle.com.